coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
And most people are hungry these days for transformation. And our entire culture is hungry for transformation. The world is hungry for transformation. And most of the major institutions are going through massive transformation. It just happens to be what the soup of the day is being served up on planet Earth, is massive transformation in every sector. And we could talk about what that means educationally, financially, spiritually, politically, ecologically, all of that. You know, those are separate conversations, also important. And suffice it to say, for the nature of our conversation, we're talking about the transformation of the medical system, particularly the psychiatric system. It's not a matter of if these medicines are going to become legal, but how and when, because they are so good. The data is so good. It's incontrovertible.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a weekly conversation series with leaders in psychedelic culture, designed for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts. Presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome back to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. I am your host, Eamon Armstrong. On today's episode, we delve into the promising future of Dr. Dan Engel's new wellness institute, Kuya, located in Austin, Texas. The center focuses on whole human care, hoping to eliminate anxiety, depression, PTSD, and other mental health issues. On the show, Dr. Engel explains his history with psychedelics and the path that led him to open the center. He also speaks about his new book, A Dose of Hope, which follows the treatment of complex PTSD with MDMA-assisted therapy, recounted through the eyes of a fictional patient. We then finish up with the future of psychedelics, the need to train 100,000 new therapists, and advice to those looking to get involved. Dr. Engel is an American psychiatrist with a background in integrative psychiatry, neurocognitive restoration, peak performance medicine, and psychedelic research. His transdisciplinary approach focuses on healing all aspects of the mind, body, and spirit to help individuals achieve optimum health, well-being, and sustained fulfillment. Dr. Engel is the founder and medical director of Kuya Institute of Transformational Medicine in Austin, Texas, Full Spectrum Medicine, a psychedelic integration and education platform, and Thank You Life, a nonprofit funding stream supporting access to psychedelic therapies. Hi, nice to see you.
Good to see you too, man.
I bet this has been a super busy time in your life.
It has indeed. Yeah, more so than any other time I can remember.
Wow. And Kuya is fully up and running at the moment?
We are fully up and running. Operational, doors open, seeing clients.
Wow. I know we've checked in about Kuya a bit before you've launched and opened. Is there anything that's popped up in the first couple of weeks at Kuya that feels alive that you'd like to talk about on the podcast today?
Yeah, it's been really beautiful to see the community come together. Already see people go through pretty transformational experiences, working with a variety of different protocols and practitioners and centers in the past, and having pretty significant treatment-resistant conditions come in and have a noticeable acceleration to their healing path. And it's not to say that any of those other centers weren't doing like the right thing. It just happens to be that we have a suite of services that when we bring all of those therapeutics into one deliverable, you get this accelerated gain.
Well, I want to talk all about that today because I'm very interested in both accelerated gain and the way that different practitioners can collaborate in this new frontier, because It is the Wild West in many ways, and there's a lot of different modalities at play. And I imagine that of all people, you might have a sense of the mosaic that they can come together to create for healing, where everybody's got their tool. I feel like many folks feel like their tool is the tool for all occasions. But when you have a full suite of practitioners and modalities available and a sort of orchestra conductor of all these different tools, that's where you get that real accelerated movement, I'd imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, and I appreciate too where you're coming from, which is how do we come together in a collaborative model to all be voices to this field of transformational medicine that's growing, that we all together want to see happen and be successful.
Well, and Dan, this is why you're the guy to talk about this with, I feel. And so just as we're kind of ambling our way into the podcast itself, just the fact that I know your work, I know your work intimately because you've actually been my psychiatrist at a time in my life, in fact, the time that I went and did my Iboga work. So I'm aware of the just the extraordinary delicacy of this space and your unique ability to see that and hold that really quite masterfully from Crossroads through to your private practice, through to what's happening with Kuya, this book that you've just completed or you've completed over the summer. There's so much that you have to share to our unique audience of psychedelic practitioners, those who aspire to be and those who are specifically interested in the healing power of psychedelics. So this has been a while coming to have this conversation, and I'm just thrilled to have this opportunity and so grateful for your time today.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for the kind words. It's good to be with you again. Thank you for the patience on your side too to continue to make this happen.
Yeah, it's a real honor to welcome you to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. You're a guest that I've wanted to speak to for a long time. And we have two really beautiful offerings coming from the world of Dr. Dan Engel at the moment, which is A Dose of Hope, the book that you've written about psychedelic therapy, and Kuya, the center that has just recently opened in Austin, Texas. And so we'll get to speak about both of them today. And so it's a very poignant time to share your gifts and the gifts of your collaborators with the world. So this is a very interesting time in psychedelic medicine and an interesting time in your offerings as well.
Yeah, thank you. It's good to be with you. And it's a poignant time indeed. This field is just accelerating leaps and bounds every day.
And so let's talk a little bit about before this field was accelerating and before people used terms like the psychedelic renaissance. You were doing work in this space, really cutting edge frontier work with major medicines before this was even, you know, a mainstream concern, this idea not only that psychedelics could be used for healing, but something as exotic to many people in the US as Iboga could be extraordinarily effective in healing opiate addiction and providing massive transformation. And of course, I'm referring to your time at Crossroads in Mexico. Mm-hmm. So maybe as a way of getting started, was that the first time that you were involved in psychedelic healing at Crossroads? Your first time as a healer yourself?
No. So my entry into medicine work was, 15 years ago now. And that was when I was running a practice in integrative psychiatry and helping kids and adults get off of medications. And we were doing great work, but there was still some of the deeper soul magic, so to speak, missing. And I was going through a transition in my life, and I just happened to be introduced to ayahuasca in a small group. And I learned more about myself in one weekend with Aya than I had in one decade of psychotherapy training and psychiatry training. And I was sold. I was just so fascinated. I really wanted to understand not only what this could do for me, but what was possible for humanity and how this could shift the entire field of psychiatry. And so I closed my clinic, moved down to the jungle via living in an ashram for a couple of years before that, kind of preparing because I knew that work was going to be deep when I eventually made the move. And when I was living down with my teachers and doing an ayahuasca apprenticeship over the course of a year, it was fascinating to see not only the experiential process of coming to terms with a lot of different parts of myself that I had been cut off from, feeling like my brain finally came online after six really bad concussions and doing a lot of other things in association with that too. It was fascinating to see the architecture of the ceremony, the architecture of the field that's generated and created, how the music and the ícaros guide the process, how to be able to identify areas of stuckness, whether it's through like a sentience, a clairsentience, and an ability to experience the energetic field by feeling tone, or it's clairvoyance, being able to actually see the density in the energy field or energy bodies. There's different medicines that when you work with them and dietas over long periods of time, you get to understand the energetic signature of those medicines, and then they have particular qualities that can enhance the ability to see or feel what needs to happen in the ceremony itself, in the healing space, to be able to support the greatest experience of wholeness for a person to go through. And that might be really uncomfortable, especially if trauma is related and it needs to come current into the space. So once I started getting into the ayahuasca apprenticeship and really being a student of it, I worked with only ayahuasca for 8 years and was very much a purist and was doing all my work underground, just noodling away in the laboratory. No one really knew what I was doing. I didn't share much with my family, with only a few friends. And then my older sister committed suicide. And when that happened, it was really sudden. It was kind of unexpected. She had been sober for a long time, over a year. And then something happened and she had a relapse fast and shot herself and was gone. And so that was a big call to action for me. And the first medicine that I wanted to understand more deeply was the medicine for addiction, which is iboga. I mean, there are other medicines for addictions for sure, but iboga is like the king in, and I say the king because it's a very masculine medicine, the king of that genre of medicines that work for addiction. And so that's what led me into iboga work and eventually working with Ibogaine and Crossroads.
I had no idea that you lost your sister. I didn't know that that was part of your healer biography, so to say, that that was a galvanizing force in your life. And I'm so sorry that that happened. And also, it seems like that's been, as I say, a galvanizing force for you in what your offering is to the world in her honor and serving those like her who are suffering from addiction the way that she had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for the reflection. It certainly was a galvanizing, catalytic experience for me. And that also included me contributing to writing The Dose of Hope. And I dedicated the book to her. You know, unfortunately, she was in 9 years separated. She's 9 years older. And she had an experience of just horrible childhood trauma. We grew up in separate households. We share the same father. She grew up in her mother's household. So our father didn't even know to the extent that she had had so much suffering and trauma as a really young girl, and just mountains of classic PTSD with doing all the right things, all the standard of care, psychopharmacology, AA, psychotherapy, gestalt therapy. The list is deep. Alcohol rehabs. And she had done it all. And unfortunately, she was in this generation where the psychedelic research between 1970 or so and 2000 plus or minus was essentially non-existent. And so these medicines like MDMA for PTSD, iboga for addiction recovery, ayahuasca for major depression, psilocybin for the stuck experiences of major depression, ketamine therapy was legal back then, but not many people even knew about it then. And it wasn't being very widely used for chronic depression. So she just happened to be in this generation that was like stuck. It wasn't the generation of the 50s and 60s that had these medicines available. And it wasn't the generation now that also is having them more available, if nothing else, by at least knowing that they're coming. Ketamine's here. We've seen an acceleration of ketamine clinics. And MDMA and psilocybin become legal in the next 18 months. And so Dose of Hope is essentially just a treatise on what's possible, what's coming. And I wrote that because I wanted people suffering in silence to know that there are options, there is hope coming, and we need to do our best as a therapeutic community and as a grassroots community to continue to demand that these medicines become legal and available.
Something that struck me about this book, Dose of Hope, you wrote it in a particular way from the perspective of this fictional main character. I think for a lot of people like yourself who have gone through somewhat of a wounded healer path where they've done a lot of their own work over a long period of time, as you certainly have and done a lot of healing, it may be hard for them and perhaps some of our listeners who've done a lot of their own work to really feel what it's like to be someone stepping into this space for the very first time. It's someone who has been suffering for a long time, someone with, in this case, it's complex PTSD in the case of the book, but someone suffering from depression. It seems like the way that you've presented this book is also instructive for a healer, a therapist, a doctor, someone who's come a long way themselves to kind of step back into the psychology of someone who is hopeless, has no idea how these medicines work, has no idea how to create the trust in the doctor-patient relationship. I wonder if, from your perspective of presenting this book and the work that you're doing now, if you have any advice for healers to better understand what it's like to be that person, perhaps like your sister, others who are just stepping into this psychedelic healing for the first time. Do you have any advice that you give to practitioners for better understanding, empathizing with, and supporting people who are completely foreign to this world?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, in the experience of supporting another along their journey of transformation, we as facilitators and guides can only help people go as far as we've gone. So if I'm in that role as a guide and I haven't already walked that path to some degree, then it's going to be mutual exploration, which is not a terrible thing. And it's not to make that wrong. We can still do good work, but it's significantly better if I've walked that path, if I have an understanding, if I have my own map that I can share with another, or other people's maps that I've iterated and proven and vetted, and be able to present that to a given person. Because most people don't know what they don't know. And most people are hungry these days for transformation. And our entire culture is hungry for transformation. The world is hungry for transformation. And most of the major institutions are going through massive transformation. It just happens to be what the soup of the day is being served up on planet Earth, is massive transformation in every sector. And we could talk about what that means educationally, financially, spiritually, politically, ecologically, all of that. You know, those are separate conversations, also important. And suffice it to say, for the nature of our conversation, we're talking about the transformation of the medical system, particularly the psychiatric system. It's not a matter of if these medicines are going to become legal, but how and when, because they are so good. The data is so good. It's incontrovertible. And because it's so good and it's significantly better than the standard of care, and there's a lot of interest in the grassroots movement, so we're seeing like this perfect confluence of all these forces with the work of MAPS and Rick Doblin and just tirelessly holding the candle for MDMA-supported psychotherapy over the last 40 years, close to 40 years. These guys have been just continuing to pound the pavement. And with the grassroots movement, recognizing that with more and more documentaries and books and podcasts on the subject, you know, there's more and more interest in the space. So my co-author and I wanted to write a book that was both helpful for the layperson to have an experience of what it might be like to be in the process and to know that it's an effective tool and to know that it's possible and it's on the horizon this way soon. And to have some context of it without having to step into a doctor's office or without having to just rely on other people's stories. Even though this is a bit of a story, we wanted to walk a person through. And then from the clinician standpoint or the facilitator standpoint or somebody who's going into this work to be a guide and a provider for others, I wanted to be able to also embed some of the what I would consider the more important core tenets and teachings and aspects of doing this kind of work in a good way. And it's certainly not an exhaustive list. And there's certainly things that we didn't include. And there are certainly other orientations to how to do this work. But as a reflection of what MAPS has done in a really good way to set the tone for a therapeutic container and to do this kind of work with MDMA as it relates to PTSD treatment and resolution, those are a good summation of the majority of entry-level considerations for facilitators to think about to be able to support their clients going through this. And because it's more of an entry-level conversation, we didn't get into a lot of esoteric terms. We kept it pretty boots on the ground. It's very spiritually agnostic. And I think that's important so that people can put their own spiritual coloring to the transformational process, because in my experience, it's very much a spiritual process when we go through a transformational experience, whether we call it God or soul or whoever's doing the healing and whatever's being healed. There are a lot of different terms and contexts to put into those arenas. And yet at the core of our being, when people go through a psychedelic awakening transformative experience, there are significant repeated themes of this experience of oneness, this experience of coming home, this experience of a spiritual opening that's never quite happened to this degree before, and a sizable one that deserves a lot of time and consideration and integration and all of that. So the felt sense of it has a lot of different kind of thematics that we can put onto it, and yet it's still helpful for us as guides to support people going along the path that they're walking themselves. They're staying in their own authority. We're not working on behalf of giving a person a fish. We start to work on behalf of teaching them how to fish, and then eventually be able to help them find their own fish and continue to access that well beyond their work with us.
Yeah, what you're describing and what I feel like really comes through in the book is an accessibility to both practitioners of many levels, but especially to potential patients, potential clients. One of the things that I thought was really helpful, you talked about how you're forwarding some core tenets to the psychedelic healing process within this book. And one of them that I think needs to just be emphasized over and over and over is that it is an uncomfortable process, that it takes time, and in some cases, it gets worse before it gets better. And that's an important story to tell. And I'm curious what your suggestions are to help message that to a patient, to help a patient through that darker before dawn experience, to build a little bit on what's in the book itself. What are some ways that you as a healer and that you suggest other practitioners manage this kind of resensitization process that creates difficult feelings that will often lead to perhaps a relapse with an addiction or just wanting to run away? Because so many folks getting introduced to this kind of healing, that's going to be the first huge challenge, is as the system gets resensitized and a lot of those negative feelings come in and it gets more difficult before it gets better, that's where they often want to cut and run. What's your advice to practitioners managing that process, or even potential patients or clients who might go through that process?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such a wonderful question. And you asking the question helps me understand too the importance of continuing to rest on and build on these core themes, because it's such a curiously and beautifully individual process. And so how do we standardize such an individual soul-centered process? So if we do that in kind of the context of taking a journey, there may be this map that we use. Maps are really helpful because they can predict different stages. And like the hero and the heroine's journey, Joseph Campbell laid down the monomyth in A Hero with a Thousand Faces. And that was just one architectural orientation to a map of transformation. There are many other maps. That's one of the more common ones used today. And so maps and kind of a trajectory and an orientation can be really helpful. Let's expect that there's going to be this valley, that things do get worse before they get better. Because usually it's like going into clean out the closet. Well, if I've just been stuffing things in the closet, the rest of my room might look really tidy and neat. But when it's time to take care of business in the closet and I start rummaging through there and everything's just going to get messy again, then I got to know that I'm going in for some work here. It might not just be like, let me get the dust buster and, you know, a dishpan. It might be like, oh, wow, we're going to need a hazmat suit and a few trash bags and maybe call in the cavalry. And so if I have that orientation, then I don't expect that, okay, I'm going to do this 3-day workshop, because most people have very busy lives today. We just run so high paced. I'm going to come skidding into home plate on a Friday afternoon, start work Friday night into Saturday night, maybe into Sunday night. And then come Monday, I'll be back at work. and doing whatever the thing is, or I'll be back at home taking care of who I usually take care of, or in the usual day to day where all of the people that know me in this previous experience are going to have all the expectations and all of the same stories. Even if I've started shedding those stories, they're going to still have the same ones because they have known me who I was, and they don't know the differential that's moving in my system right now. So the maps can be really helpful, that kind of trajectory of preparation, experience, and integration. Or the map in that same kind of three-stage process, the map of initiation that starts with becoming destabilized, becoming disoriented. It's like the ruffling of the norm. And that destabilization process just by itself can be really freaky. And people may want to pull the plug at that point. Because if that's really uncomfortable, when you go into liminality, when you totally lose your identity or a good portion of your identity, or you reclaim a significant portion of a traumatized or exiled part, and now that comes into the center of the circle, then now there's a redefining moment of who now am I with this part? This shame, this guilt, this avoidance, this fear, this anger, this bitterness, this rage, whatever hasn't been metabolized, whatever hasn't been moving through the system. So all of that just soup of transformation happens. And then after all of that, who do I become when I, you know, unmask, unveil, or the cocoon unzips and now I'm back in the world? And that can be, for me, that was the hardest part. I went into a year of a suicidal depression after I moved back from the jungle to the United States. I couldn't deal with culture, couldn't deal with how fast we are, how aggressive we are, how short we are, how inconsiderate we are to one another and to the planet and to the coming generations, and how wasteful we are and how much we have and how little we give gratitude for on a regular basis. I mean, it's like, oh, that was just like crazy. I felt like an albatross trying to land. You know, I was just like tumbling and like, oh, that's not graceful. What the hell's happening? And so I lived in a tent for a year, just getting my bearings back. And so all of that to say, like any one of those three parts can be really uncomfortable. Sometimes they're all uncomfortable. And yet that's the initiation. When we go from one previous level of existence to another, and think about it when children move through teenage years into adulthood, or maybe just from childhood to adolescence itself, that has the trajectory of hormones and self-identity and trying to figure out who your clique is and where are the people that I'm connected to. And, oh, I'm supposed to figure out now college and where you want me to go and what I'm going to major in and what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. I don't even know who I am. I mean, that's a bit of a mind twist right there. So there's all these initiations that we just kind of assume are going to happen naturally and gracefully. And we don't really have initiatory practices in our culture. So if I'm working with a client, I get curious about that kind of stuff. Yeah, I'm going to do the classic kind of, I'm a psychiatrist, and I do tend to think that childhood has a lot of bearing on who we are now. So I tend to ask the kind of classic psychiatry questions. How was your childhood? But also, how are you now? What's your identity now? Okay, that was some of the mapping system. That was one. Number two, I'll put them together, although they're largely different in their energetic and how you source them internally versus externally, but they're both helpful. And that's faith and hope. Faith is more of an internal process. Hope is more of an external process. Faith is the belief in something without having the evidence. Because if we had evidence, it would just be proof and we wouldn't need to really solidify our faith. Hope is typically the desire for an external force to intervene on our behalf. Both are helpful. And it's helpful for, if I'm working with a client, it's helpful for me to strategically share a part of my story, but not so that it overshadows their story or I keep stealing the microphone. Like they're in the driver's seat. I'm in the passenger seat. And it's helpful for me to grab the mic if I can see that they're about to drive off a cliff. But then I want to make sure that they know the risks and benefits. And if you feel like you need to drive off that cliff, that's your choice. And here's the map that we're using, and here's the context. And by the way, I drove off that cliff. It's not very fucking comfortable. Let me just tell you how that went. Just a little snippet. And it might actually have its time and place. And so hope and faith are just paramount, if not the actual bedrock for me, and for me coming out of the tent, so to speak, and finding my feet back on the ground when I did come back from the jungle. And that was Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. The dude just laid it down. He set such a bar. Every time I'm having these kind of conversations, I bring him up that book, I always get chills. That's for me, the bedrock. Anytime I'm fritzed out, anytime I'm feeling less than or confused or in doubt, or like, what is all this just craziness happening around me? Or I feel like I've got like daggers in my back, or, you know, like whatever it is, I just remember that dude's, like, if I can just take a moment out of my own petty, spoiled suffering and just remember, like, oh, there are avatars that have walked in the deepest trenches that I'm probably in this lifetime won't have to understand fully, and came out in service to humanity, in beauty, in grace, in harmony. Like Nelson Mandela in the jail for 27 years, banging on rocks, coming out and leading apartheid movements towards equality. I mean, there's so many stories of avatars. So those kind of stories, faith and hope, it freaking helps. And it's a lot harder without it. Maps help, faith and hope help, and community helps. A community of like-minded, like-hearted brothers and sisters also going on this path, so we know that we're not doing it in isolation.
Well, that community piece is so key. You know, you were speaking of initiations, and in a traditional initiation, I think a lot about male rites of passage because that's been some of my work. But one of the key features of a male's rite of passage in a traditional society is that once that man is returned to his community as a man, it's a return to the community where not only has he gone through an experience that shows him that he is a man, when he returns, his community expects him to be a man. You've done the experience. Now you are a man. We have this expectation of you. And it's sort of the opposite of when we think about someone going back into the same environment with the same signals, the same stories, the same cues, going into this environment where it's like, oh, well, you're a man now. When we know that you can do it because we've seen you go through this initiation and we welcome you into this community as a man. And that experience of being able to go through a transformative experience and step into community with an expectation of you, I think is a key part of the transformational process and a key part of how our healing turns into service, and that service reinforces our healing and helps network this kind of web of community where there's an accountability for us, where we were once, you know, so laden with our own sorrows, as you've said, my privileged petty sorrows, I share them, I have those ones too. But then when we see the expectation of the community, and this maybe is a good time to open up the conversation about Kuya, because my understanding of Kuya is that it is itself a community, that a community is coming together around Kuya as a transformational power station, perhaps we can call it. So let's talk about community and integration as a way of entering the conversation into this discussion of what Kuya is and what Kuya is offering.
Mm-hmm. I'm just receiving the words of Kuya as a transformational power station.
Right? It feels right. I haven't been there yet, but from everything I've heard, it feels right to me.
Yeah. Yeah, when we built Kuya, so we just opened 3 weeks ago. This Friday will be 4 weeks. And in January, it'll be 4 years that we've been working on it. So it's been a fairly long build and perfectly timed, and just all the strategic delays. As any transformational experience will be a circuitous path, it's not a linear path. Transformation is not a linear path. So it involves a mystery mindset as opposed to a mastery mindset. Mastery mindset is more like entrepreneurial or organizational, or you see the goal, you identify what you want, you chart the path to get there, you set up the why, because most paths are reasonably challenging. Do I have enough of a why to see it through? And then you set up the accountability structures. And so it's a fairly masculine process. It's helpful. And we have that. The transformational process is very mysterious. It's very nonlinear. It's very circular and backwards at times. And so it can feel arduous, especially if we don't have something like a map and something like a community. So in the process of building Kuya, I was really excited about the physical space. She's beautiful. I feel like a proud parent, just welcoming the child into the world. I think she's beautiful. And most people walk in and they're like, holy cow, this is amazing. And I was also really excited about the therapeutic suite because we have so many tools and technologies that I've never seen another center put together.
Can you give some examples of what some of those therapeutic mm-hmm. technologies are?
Yeah, happy to. Let me wrap up on the community piece and then I'll go in. So essentially, we built the clinic that we wanted to see and be a part of, but hadn't existed yet. So the physical space is amazing. The therapeutic suite's amazing. And even though those two are amazing, I still am experiencing more and more knowing that the most fertile ground for the transformation to happen is the community that's coming together. It's amazing to see the relationships they're already forming in just a few weeks. We already have 100 members signed up without any marketing, just through organic traffic. Because once they see what we're up to and in the space and what's provided, they want to be a part of it on a regular basis. So our center is 10,000 square feet. It's a fairly large center with a variety of different offers. And 2,000 square feet are just community space because we wanted to have a place where people could come and not only go through their own process individually, but also be around others that are going through their process. Because when we know that we're not doing this alone and there are others who are going through their own version of a transformational process, because, oh, by the way, at this time on the planet, we're all going through transformation, like it or not. Because we're all a part of the same ecosphere. We're all a part of the same planetary structure, the same group and global mind. So we can't not be going through it. Even if it looks like somebody's going through a massive transformation, somebody else is going through a mild one, that might be true. It's a bit of a differential, but still the transformation's happening. So as we see the community come together and people are starting to have these really accelerated healing processes happen, then they become really excited about this experience and the trajectory that they're on. And so to see people start to share their experience with one another, or at least to just be able to have, it's interesting how so many awesome conversations are happening in our IV suite and in our sauna, because we have a 20-person sauna, and my average sauna time has gone from 30 minutes to 2 hours because I'm just in the midst of all these amazing conversations that are so rich and that I want to be a part of too. And as we're talking about just those two, I'll paint the picture for the rest of our therapeutic suite. So we have an IV suite that has 5 IV chairs, and that's like vitamin mineral solutions, NAD, which is essentially a cellular energetic reparative mechanism, B vitamin derivative, and peptides in what we could call like more of a healing kind of orientation, as well as a regenerative performance orientation. So if somebody has an acute injury, there's peptides that support the acute injury mechanisms to kick back in even more actively and fully. And then if people are already going from good to great, then there are performance and regenerative medicine peptides that essentially help refine the system in its level of, whether it's clarity of concentration, clarity of movement, clarity of accelerated healing and performance in a variety of different domains. We were using biologics too, so exosomes, stem cells, but the feds have now put a pause on that. So that's our IV regenerative medicine suite. And then we have also part of what we would call the membership or wellness package, or kind of more full program, contrast therapy. So sauna and cold plunge. So we have 3 cold plunges, 20-person sauna. So it can be like a really awesome group process. And what contrast therapy does is it helps to increase the energetic valence and like a hormonal power that a given person's in the midst of experiencing or moving towards. Because a lot of people are just with the experience of stress or the speed of culture, or perhaps not knowing the value of some of these therapeutics. When you stress, where you have this hormetic stress, both in the sauna side and the cold side, in the hot and the cold, then your body builds this cellular resilience and you also build this mental resilience. Because anytime I get in the cold plunge, it's still super freaking cold, but I'm now more adapted and I know how to be with that level of discomfort. It's something about like building the willingness to be in an uncomfortable experience because you know the outcome is beneficial. And just by itself, cold plunge and cold exposure, if done in the right way, is, in my experience, and I haven't seen the data that would suggest that there's another more effective single practice than cold exposure for optimizing mood, particularly in the depressive arena. If somebody has a lot of anxiety and they already generate a lot of like extra catecholamines that are heightening their internal system, then it might be, yeah, let's do a little bit of cold, but let's focus on the sauna and let's focus on the float. Because the cold plunge is very much activating. It essentially, your body thinks it's going to die. So it starts getting all the sluggish immune modulators off the couch and into action. And so it increases cold exposure 3 to 4 minutes at upper 30s to 40 degrees increases norepinephrine 500%, which is, norepinephrine is the neurotransmitter for action and focus and motivation and moving forward. Dopamine does that a little bit as well, but essentially epinephrine is like what marshals our response to be able to engage a particular challenge and move through that. And that's the definition of resilience, is the ability to adapt in the midst of challenge. So your body builds this greater adaptive capacity. And if we look around the general makeup of not only people in our country and culture, but globally, there's something to be said that the Western kind of one button purchase power has made us less than resilient than we were 50, 100, 200 years ago. Because so many of our needs are pretty immediately taken care of. So with that privilege comes a lot of benefit. It's allowed us the opportunity to stay in just these accelerated creative development phases, but it's left us less emotionally, mentally, and physically resilient. So we wanted to bring together a suite of services is essentially building resilience, because we need not only people that are awake and inspired for life, we also need people pretty freaking resilient, because there's a lot of challenges on the planet right now. And there's going to become more and more challenges on the planet as we get current with how many things are out of balance, how many of the systems are going through massive transformation. In the midst of transformation, it's really freaking helpful to have resilience. I mentioned the contrast that I started to talk about the float tanks. And floating is like meditation on steroids. Because it's the first time without environmental stimuli that people are able to really get in touch with an expanded state of consciousness, still fully sober and clear, where they can explore the nature of their subconscious mind, not having to use any other outside or altered substance. So there's no sight, no sound, no gravity, no proprioception. Like 80% of what the brain's usually filtering or receiving from environmental stimuli is now not there. So you have all this extra like cerebral and psychic landscape to start to explore what's behind the curtain. And it's phenomenal to be able to have people go through a ketamine session and be able to float immediately afterwards. There's a 1 hour or so buffer time because people need to be fully back in their body, fully stable on their feet. We make sure that they're fully lucid before they go into the float tank. And so people will go through a process of ketamine experience. That's all upstairs where our psychotherapy suites are. So we have 5 rooms. They're all elementally themed. So people have a different experience if they want to be in a different environment to go through a different internal process. Our music suite is also scripted to go over the arc of a process between 3 to 4 sessions, depending on how people's accelerated response is. And so when people go through the ketamine work, and then now they get into active journal time, so we have an integration room, and then they get a light sauna and stay in that more fluid, expanded state. Then they get in the massage chair and then they go float. And the ketamine sessions are 90 minutes to 2 hours. So you have that 2 hours, and then you have the integration practices that I just mentioned for 2 hours. So it's a good 4 hour process. And when people really avail themselves to giving the extra time for those 2 hours of integration, it's amazing to see the accelerated gains happen, because you're not leveraging just the ability to put somebody to sleep with ketamine, because that's a dissociative anesthetic. It does that. If you give them a lot of ketamine, people will go to sleep. And oftentimes when they wake up, they feel better, which is amazing and great. And that's primarily a neurologic reset. There's some reset there too at the default mode. We're understanding more and more about how ketamine works neurologically and psychologically. And yet, as mentioned, I'm not as interested in just giving a person a fish. For sure, if somebody's starving, I'm going to give them a fish. If they're standing on the ledge and they either have no options, or they have pharmaceuticals, or they have ketamine, I'm going to say, well, you should probably use ketamine because it works faster than pharmaceuticals. It's safer, less side effects. And if they don't have access to that because there's not an immediate ketamine provider, now people are doing at-home ketamine sessions, so it is a little bit more available. We don't use that kind of orientation or practice, but that is an option. And then if people only have pharmaceuticals, I say, well, if that's all you have, then use that. Because that's what pharmaceuticals do typically, is they arrest the symptoms. But if we're going through a transformational arc, we want to understand how to actually become intimate with those symptoms, become intimate with the discomfort. So I'm not necessarily excited about people suffering, but I am excited when I see them on a transformational path and they start to become more intimate with something that's been locked off for a long time. And it's still been negatively impacting their life. They just maybe didn't have the time or the space or the support to become more familiar with it, get into the weeds with it, start to learn about it, be in the space where we can give that part or that fear or that shame or that guilt or that whatever the thing is, give that experience, that feeling tone, that part, give that the microphone for a little while. And let's just see what it has to say. And let's get interested and let's lean in. While people are also, before we do any of that work, part of the preparation is self-regulation. That's why the flotation tanks are also really good to help people self-regulate, come back to your breath. If you're fearful of getting in the tank, awesome, fabulous. Then let's work with that. Because if you're fearful about getting into a tank, then you probably are going to be fearful about having a ketamine experience. And all of this just builds on the other medicines to come. Like ketamine's helping us with our systems. If you were to tell me even just a few years ago that I'd be running a ketamine center, I'd say you're crazy, because I'm not interested in working with dissociative synthetic anesthetic. I had a lot of judgments. I was an Aya purist. I was a natural medicine purist. I've been raw vegan for years at a time. And I took the monastic precepts in the Theravada tradition. I've been a four-year spirit dancer. So there are certain practices, certain ways that I live my life, that I had a lot of judgment to something like ketamine as a synthetic dissociative anesthetic. I said, why would, that's the last thing. And that was also a dogma. That was a kind of a narrowed focus. And then once I started hearing more and more about people that I trusted, people's healing experiences with ketamine, I got interested. And then my truth evolved over time to appreciate now, like, okay, all medicines have their sacred place at the table. All medical disciplines have their sacred place at the table. Western medicine is just one arm of a variety of different excellent health orientations and practices. So ketamine, yes, is working for us right now because it's allowing the masses to become more and more familiar with altered states and more accepting of altered states. It's allowing us to solidify our systems and slowly open up the collective readiness for MDMA and psilocybin to become legal in the next 18 months.
So you've described Kuya as the clinic that you always wanted, that you always wanted to work at, that you always wanted to create. And it sounds like it really does have everything. At the same time, having everything is not inexpensive. And I can see Kuya a little bit through the lens of maybe like a Tesla, like where you start with the premium model that's sexy and that has everything. And then there's ways to iterate from that to become more accessible. Mm-hmm. I think this idea of accessibility in psychedelic therapy is so important, because if these psychedelics allow us to heal, to grow, allow performance enhancement at an exponential scale, or at least a scale that's far more rapid than what's otherwise available. And it's only accessible to those who have the resources. This great revolutionary tool can also be something that impacts inequality, maybe even widens inequality, if it's not accessible. So I'm curious, with Kuya, how are you thinking about the accessibility of healing in the context of creating this? Is it, as I've imagined, like a Tesla kind of thing where you create this perfect center and then you can iterate from it and create other centers? Is there some kind of process or scholarships? How are you thinking about the issue of equal access, accessibility, and equity in the psychedelic space?
Excellent question. For me, this is the heart of the movement and where we're going. And I think your comparison to creating the first model that sets the tone, sets the bar, so to speak, I think there's some value in that, so that it can be an inspiring orientation of a therapeutic model to work towards and to make sure that it is an inclusive process and an inclusive model. The last thing we need to do is create more and more inequality and challenge to accessibility. And so when I think of how we're doing that already, our memberships are pretty reasonable. Like, you can drop in to see us for a day pass to do unlimited sauna and cold plunge, hang out in the community space, we have a tea and tonic bar, get a tea, read a book, have an awesome conversation. You can do all that for $15, which is about the price of going to a movie.
Yeah, that actually is quite accessible. I wasn't expecting $15 to be the yeah. So yeah, that is quite accessible.
That's pretty accessible. And then if you come in if you want to do that for the whole month and just come in and do cold plunge and sauna, you can do an unlimited monthly membership, I think is $65. And that's essentially where we're starting, and we're building from there. And then we have memberships. If you want to get a certain number of IVs per month or a certain number of floats per month, you can kind of scale it from there. So if you wanted to do like one of those a month or two of those a month or one of those every week, those are different price points and entries. Now, as it relates to ketamine, right now we are with others collecting as much data as we can to tell the story of why these therapeutics should be reimbursed through insurance providers or reimbursed through small business owners if it's an entrepreneurial insurance plan. Because if we know that the average person, this is a rough average, if you look at the different numbers associated, whether it's hospitalizations, pharmaceutical care, therapist coverage care, the average person in our country with major depressive disorder over a longer period of time. To have major depressive disorder, MDD, you have to have depressive symptoms for at least 6 months versus going through just a major depressive episode after a trauma or a loss, like bereavement. So if somebody has depression, chronic depression in our country, the average annual cost to the insurance providers is about $16,500. And if we can show, we only opened 4 weeks ago, so we're just now collecting the data of people going through our program and process. And the data that we've already collected of people over just the last few weeks is already better than we had expected. We're tracking biometrics, neurometrics, psychometrics, life metrics. If I can take a snapshot of a person when they walk in the door before they do anything, then I can get a sense of where they are at baseline and then put them through our suite of services and then take a snapshot at the end of that, including their subjective experience, including the storytelling and the narrative of the process they went through, which you can't quantify. That's the qualitative data. We're also doing the quantitative data. So when we can tell the new story that, okay, for a 2-week immersive program, if somebody was to come in from out of town and give us 2 weeks and go deep with our entire therapeutic suite, and they're with us like all day, every day, and we compare that, because we're doing quantitative EEG brain maps, we're doing 4 ketamine sessions over that time frame. We're doing neurostim 10 sessions. We're doing IVs. They're doing their integration work in the tanks float tanks, cold tanks, and the sauna. And we're giving them targeted supplements based on their individual neurobiology. And if they have gut dysbiosis, immunological dysregulation, hormonal dysregulation, all of that needs to be taken into consideration. Because if the reason that the person has major depression in the first place is hypothyroidism, and we're not picking that up, or they have longstanding viral infection and we're not picking that up, or some other organic etiology and causative factor and we're not picking that up, then we're not looking at the whole thing, the whole picture, the whole person. And so we do a pretty strong, like, quantitative metric analysis, intervene at all the necessary points. And then if our outcome measures show that our efficacy rates over the calendar year are better than the standard of care at $16,000, and the standard of care is an annuity plan where people are just re-upping for pharmaceuticals in this kind of no-end model, versus if somebody goes through a program like ours or another program, and then at 6 and 12 months, they're actually significantly better. Their self-narratives are better. Their life is moving in an awesome direction. They're relieved of their core suffering and major psychiatric symptoms. All of that tells the new story. And that's essentially what we saw with solar. When solar panels came out, they were super expensive, and now they're much more cost-effective. And in fact, some people actually get paid for installing. I mean, it depends on how long you're, you know, tracking that repayment. Now there's a new story. And it's actually not just an individual choice because I might save a few dollars on my electrical bill. It's more like, oh, this choice is actually helpful for the planet because we can be as energy efficient as possible. Well, what does it mean if I can be actually not only psychologically resilient and physiologically vital? Because the body needs vitality just like the mind needs creativity. What does it also look and feel like if I'm able to move through my life more efficiently to work towards the goals that I have? And most people are going through the same process of the desired endpoint. And we have to make our way through what our culture says is success. So much money, so much like Instagram and social media likes and like all of that. But at the end of the day, everybody's going for the same things: happiness, contentment, contribution. If I can make my way more efficiently through the dark night, through the transformational experience and get to that point, that has a different qualitative endpoint. So we're trying to do it from both perspectives. Look at the quantitative data and be able to actually do a cross comparison of how we believe our therapeutic model is better, not only better in efficacy rates than the standard of care, it's actually more cost effective in the long term than the standard of care. Now we have a lot to be able to go to, a lot of data, a lot of evidence to be able to go to the existing bodies of the standard of care, whether it's the American Medical Association, and help them understand the importance of having these medicines available as efficiently as possible, and to do that work as effectively as possible. And we have a lot of evidence to go to the insurance providers and say, actually, it would be really helpful for you to reimburse these therapeutics because this is the outcome and these are the outcome measures. And not only is it like good for your bottom line, but people actually feel better, which means ultimately, if I'm talking to a small business owner, that means your employees are going to work better. I mean, they're just like, they're charged with life. And so when people are charged with life, they find their dharma, they find their purpose, they follow that, and they're proud of it because doing what we're here to do feels life-giving and it's life-affirming. So these are all the storytelling pieces that not only are necessary for the data, because data moves science, it's also necessary for the story to be told in this kind of way because story moves culture. So data moves science, story moves culture. And when we bring those two together, now we can actually have the best likelihood to support the change that needs to happen.
Well, and culture is changing rapidly in mm-hmm. respect to psychedelic healing. And there is a massive bottleneck on the horizon. And that is with the therapists themselves. I've heard you say that we need 100,000 therapists, that we are going to need more practitioners of all different modalities, but particularly those who can hold space for these kind of massive transformations. So looking at this future, like the solar panels where things become accessible, insurance recognizes the cost effectiveness. Perhaps there's a little bit of a breaking of the stronghold of this of the pharmaceutical companies and their incentives. Whatever this kind of rosy future looks like, where as a culture, we have really gotten clear on the power of these experience as medicine transformational containers. We still have this extraordinary bottleneck of the therapists themselves, those who've been trained to really hold space for whatever happens in these transformational environments, because it's not simply psychedelic peer support. We need actually well-trained, experienced healers. So how do we achieve that onboarding of psychedelic practitioners and healers in the limited time frame that we're trying to absolutely paradigmatically revolutionize healthcare? What do we do to create these 100,000 therapists?
Yeah, it's happening slowly and surely. There are more and more organizations that are coming up to the surface, offering these kinds of trainings, more and more CME, continuing medical education trainings to therapists, physicians, practitioners of a variety of different sorts to not only get their annual quota for CME credits taken care of, but also to learn a valuable skill to see if they might want to be a participant. When I say participant, to participate in that, let's get you curious enough to see if you want to opt in. And ideally get you curious enough not to just be a facilitator, but to be a participant first. Because there's so many people in this space that are running huge organizations, million and billion at this point dollar organizations that have not been through a transformational process themselves. So to be able to run a significant business in a new industry and really not understand it at a deep level of gnosis, a deep level of experiential connection, then the orientation is going to be still driven from the ego's expectation of what needs to happen. Maybe that's driven by profit margins because ketamine has a great profit margin. It's very inexpensive. You can give people ketamine at home, maybe have a coach with them on a virtual platform. And if you have a model and scale a model like that, there's a great profit margin available. I'm not here to say that approach is either wrong or, and that is actually happening. And I know a ton of amazing coaches that are phenomenal and that in that arena, that might be okay. The challenge points around doing that are if somebody goes through a really intense trauma recovery process, then you're not in the room with them. And that's by itself very different. And you have to have facilitators that understand the transformational arc of being able to support a person going into their deepest work and their deepest wounds. And so on the trajectory of facilitation, you have sitters, you have facilitators, and you have trackers. And so sitters are essentially holding safe container and safe space, and which is vital, super important. They may not have all the skills of a facilitator. Also facilitator, I would put like therapist oftentimes has training. They've been through their own process. They've had mentorship. They use particular maps to be able to understand and translate a person's subjective experience and help them identify deeper levels of their own reality. And they also have guiding virtues and values. So as a facilitator, it's really helpful to not project your own stuff onto another person's process. One of a number of values and rules and engagement. And then you have trackers or people like facilitators exponentially effective because there's a level of intuitive spidey sense and knowing that is effective when you can start reading like Mark Wolin describes in It Didn't Start With You, which is his book on transgenerational trauma. It's a phenomenal book. And he talks about tracking the trauma language. And when he goes through his kind of narratives and what he's looking for, it's like Boyd Vardy talking about tracking lions. You get a sense through that work of reading the landscape, the physical landscape, the emotional landscape, the psychic landscape. And that takes time. And it takes a development, particularly with mentors and being in the experience long enough to gain those skills. So this is just an example of how we can strategize the entry points, because some people may want to come in as just sitters and to be a part of it and to lovingly hold space. Some people are already therapists and now they want to get trained as facilitators. Okay, great. Then how does what you've already learned translate to the facilitation? I know some amazing people who have never studied psychotherapy, but just already are phenomenal trackers. That's like they've been groomed to do this more energetic soul level work that at time isn't as mental as like the field of psychology might be in the Western framework. Like many of my teachers in the ayahuasca traditions, they don't understand the Western psyche, but they're Jedi energetic trackers. So these are some of the differentials, different ways that ketamine can be used, whether it's at home, as mentioned. That's another way to scale it out. And understandably, when there's people suffering, like if my sister was suffering at home right before she had a relapse and shot herself, and the best intervention was to give her ketamine at home and walk her through an at-home process and program, if that was available and it was safe to do that because they thought about all the different considerations, I would say, yeah, do that thing. If that, like the Buddha said, use the medicines that are available to you. And it's also important to know that because of the depth and degree of the trauma experience that she was in the midst of uncovering, she needs to work with somebody who really freaking knows what they're doing, and ideally not just do it at home. Because so much trauma happens in isolation, and so much of the early defense mechanisms that get solidified around trauma are about isolating the trauma just to, in order to get through it, in order to psychologically reconstitute on the other side of it. So ideally, we have the experience of connection to a therapist and a community that supports that healing to happen. So if we come back to, that was a little bit of a circuitous way to say, okay, there are a lot of different considerations that relates to training 100,000 therapists. And when I say 100,000 therapists, that was also a number that Rick Doblin's been fond of orienting us towards. And I think it's true. When we look at the scale of trauma and the demand for these services, that's a reasonable number to aspire to. And it may not only be 100,000 therapists in our country. This might be like in the industrialized world where the average neurosis combined with the scope of individual trauma, as well as the collective trauma that we're all going through, and what we're appreciating that we wrote about in the book is this now growing awareness of complex PTSD. It's quite likely that the scale and demand for these kind of services is pretty freaking massive. So to be able to train 100,000 therapists is doable. We simply need effective training programs that are offered at scale with experiential process and a lot of ongoing deep mentorship for those going through that training program and methodology. I'm excited that so many people are getting more and more into this work because I think it's necessary. And I think you mentioned this before, right before maybe we started, it's like the wild, wild west. Any new industry is like the wild west, which has its excitements and its inspiring moments. And it also has a lot of its own shadow and things to take serious consideration of.
You know, there's a nice segue here to the question that I always end this podcast with, which is to give you an opportunity to speak directly to those psychedelic therapists who are currently practicing, whether it's ketamine-assisted therapy or whether they're in one of these clinical trials, or also those who aspire to be those students of CIIS or Fluence or other programs, or those listeners who have not even gotten started. They've maybe held some space at a party somewhere, but they know that they feel called. So this sort of cohort of healers of all different stages who we've just been referring to our need for. This is your opportunity to speak directly to them and share whatever you would like to share for those healers and those aspiring healers who are listening today.
Yeah, thanks, Eamon. When we put our orientation towards being of service to others, we're acknowledging and fulfilling the blueprint that we've come in to be a part of. If we can talk in these terms, the soul level blueprint, the thing that each of us has come to do is unique to each of us. And in the art and the alchemy and the science and the practice of facilitation for others and on behalf of others, when we do that work, everything that was really uncomfortable, really hard, really challenging, that's already happened, and everything that is really hard and really challenging and really uncomfortable that hasn't happened, and everything that's really uncomfortable and really challenging that is happening now, all of that now has purpose. Because it's in service to each of us becoming more whole. And when we become more and more whole, we can help others become more and more whole that much more effectively. So there's a way, not only does it normalize like the wounded healer, maybe we can recontextualize that. It starts to paint a picture of the whole healer that we're all in service to, that we're all walking towards. And for me, that always helps because it recognizes that the person that I'm in service to and that I'm facilitating on behalf of, we're pretty much the same. I have maybe less hair than they do, or you know, different skin tone or different narratives and biographies or whatever the thing is, but we're still in a hairless monkey suit going through this process of transformation. We're just doing it through different eyes and different experience. So if I can see that, then I can know, just slow it down for a moment to recognize that I'm in service to this person's transformation and their transformation is in service to my own holding too. And it just takes a moment, sometimes for me, a really big moment to drop in enough to really get that and remember that. Because in the midst of the busyness, and I'm much more busy than I'm used to being. So at times it takes me a little while to slow down and connect to in the way that I'm more used to being able to do automatically. And we all have whatever the thing is that both accelerates our role as a facilitator and also challenges it. So for me, it can be like, I got so many ideas sometimes, my mental energy needs to slow down so I can connect. Or I might be stuck in the disappointment because something that I thought was going to go a particular way didn't go a particular way. And I got to get out of my own way long enough to really serve this person. All of that helps me become more and more fully present with the sacred role that I've chosen to be a part of and chosen in this moment to serve. And I don't think there's another orientation. I'm biased because I don't know what I don't know, but at least in the field of medicine, this field feels like the most accelerated, inspiring opportunity for hope to see a massive transformation happen in our relationships, in our communities, and the world at large. Because everything that we're talking about going through massive transformation starts first and foremost with consciousness. And these tools and technologies are in service to expanding, opening, and accelerating a person's experience of their own beauty, their own glory, their own genius. And that's all just another word for consciousness.
Oh, wow. It's a beautiful mic drop there. Very poetic landing. So the book is A Dose of Hope, And we'll have a link for where you can purchase it now in the show notes. And just to send us home, if you could tell us a little bit about where people can find you personally to follow your work. Kuya, I imagine that you're on social networks already. Maybe you're not, but website. Tell us all how to connect more deeply with you, Kuya, and the work that you're doing.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. So yes, Kuya, as we've been mentioning, spelled K-U-Y-A. The URL is kuya.life. Kuya means love in Quechua. And a couple of other organizations I'll mention. One is thankyoulife.org. And that is a funding stream and scholarship platform to support people to receive medicine work that wouldn't be able to support it or pay for it on their own. So to your point before around like scholarships and doing our best to make this kind of work accessible, that is a nonprofit that we've just got up and running and are really stoked to see how it comes into the world and supports even more people. And then my own personal site's Dr. Dan Engel. And Full Spectrum Medicine is my education advocacy platform for psychedelic therapy research and integration. We have a ton of information, a lot of pre-recorded interviews, podcasts, and material on there that people can access for free.
Beautiful. Wow, there's so much has happened in your life since we first connected, and you had accomplished so much prior to that. And I'm just so happy to see Kuya on the map. I'm sure many of our listeners, and myself included, are like, $15. I don't live in Austin, but it does seem like a fun place to be. Thank you so much for everything that you do for the psychedelic community broadly. I know that you're involved in a lot of things, and you mentioned this robust mentorship that is so necessary now, and I know that you do that. I know that you do that with individuals, but also your presence holds that candle as well. You're one of our luminaries, Dr. Dan, and we are grateful. And I am personally grateful for you taking the time today to be on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. And thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me on, Eamon. It's been a wonderful conversation, and the depth of your own questions really helps me understand how much you know and are involved in this work. So thank you for getting the message out there and sharing it in a good way.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.